This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, your source for the most accurate but conflicting information about the U.S. economy. I mean, doesn't it seem like every day somebody's on the radio saying, don't worry, the banking system is safe, and then you look at what the market is doing today and they say, well, people are worried about the banking system. So Stephen Esposito, help me out on this. You're the president
How are you?
Managing partner at Yellowstone Wealth Management. That's a fair read on my part, isn't it, Stephen?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, there's a lot of confusion, a lot of misinformation. I also think short sellers are having a field day today, which is exaggerating the moves. But generally speaking, the economy's in really good shape. That's actually one of the problems, if you can believe that. And there's fears on what's going on with the inverted yield curve, which we've talked about in the past. So a lot of things happening causing panic, and I just wouldn't panic. I would look for an opportunity to buy some of these institutions if they continue to fall with the nibble here and there.
I'll talk to you about that in a second. To what degree is the Fed quarter point move having on all of this? And have we peaked? I'm wondering if the next opportunity for them to raise interest rates, they won't raise interest rates.
I'm with you on that. I don't think they should have done this one, but that's me. I would have held and waited because, you know, the biggest thing they're looking at is unemployment. That's a 6 to 9 month lag. But I hope they're done. I think, you know, we're at the highest rate in 16 years right now. And the difference between a 10-year rate and a 2-month is almost 200 basis points. I mean, it's crazy. But their goal is to kill inflation. And I think they're overdoing it. It has more to do with the labor side. And I think you're right. I think, you know, in crisis is opportunity. And I would look to buy some of these things because it's definitely not an economy that's weak. That's not the problem we're having.
But, no, yeah. We're negative for the year on the Dow right now. So where are the opportunities? Mm-hmm. What sectors do you like?
You look at a lot of the institution, you look at a lot of the, honestly, some of these regionals. I mostly own the larger banks, which have come down, but nowhere near as bad as some of the regional banks. But I'm looking at those much closer and going to be nibbling in some of that sector here shortly. But I think if you look at the general economy, the automobile companies have come out with great numbers. If you look at the travel industry, if you look at the cruise line stocks are ironically up today. The consumer is really strong. And I know that sounds crazy, but that's actually the problem. It's not the cost of goods because we have commodities dropping like a stone. Look at oil. Look at any of these commodities that are out there. You have the money supply at the lowest level. M2 money supply growth, the lowest level in 80 years. You've got rents are actually down, but it's not showing up in their numbers yet. So you've got a lot of things going on. I mean, commodities again. I'll go back. Gasoline down 75. Eggs are down 80%. Lumber down 75. These are off their highs. Wheat down 50%, cotton down 46%, oil down 40%. And the LEI, leading economic indicators, have been down 12 months in a row. I mean, how much more do they want over at the Fed? So I think they've overshot the runway.
But are you saying that we still are spending too much, that we have too many dollars chasing too few goods? Is that the problem still?
No, actually, I'm not going to believe I'm going to say this. It's the unemployment rate is too low, and people are continuing to do well. And the consumer's strong. I mean, the consumer, for the first time in 16 years, is receiving a rate of return they haven't seen at this high level in the 4 or 5% range. That's why they're so flush. Look at the restaurants. Look at the airlines. Look at Hilton and Marriott. I'm not recommending the stocks, but the CEOs were on the other day, and they said business is great. There's strong demand. They don't see any slowdown.
Yeah, I wonder, though, Stephen, if a lot of that great business they're getting is on people's credit cards. Aren't we overspending our assets, our savings right now?
I don't know about that. I think they're earning a rate of return they haven't earned in 16 years on the money market. Remember, before we were earning zero, and if you're in Europe, you're having a negative rate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're overspending. I just think they're choosing to spend it in different places, more on goods rather than experiences than goods. So I just think it's a really weird time to be in the market, but I think it's also the best opportunity because, let's face it, the competition is a 6 month or 1 year CD or treasury bill, which is good. But when you go past 1 or 2 years, the rates are horrible. The 10 years at 3.33. So once we get through this psychological crisis and the Fed, gets its act together and starts to calm everybody down, I think you'll see a dramatic change as investors thinking long-term aren't going to be happy with the treasury bond at 3.3%. But a 5% money market right now is pretty good when you're scared.
Yeah.
I think that's what it is. But that will change when the Fed starts to lower rates at some point in the future.
Stephen Esposito, President, Managing Partner at Yellowstone Wealth Management. Okay, Stephen, I'll call you again. Thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Bree Fowler is here again from CNET. Bree is a senior reporter there and is reporting today on, what's the story here, Bree? Facebook has not been doing enough to protect young people's data?
Yeah, the Federal Trade Commission is not happy with them. They're looking to impose what's called a blanket prohibition on Meta's collection of young people's personal data.
What is that? What data are we talking about?
Well, I mean, Meta, which owns both Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and a few other things, they collect data through their social media channels. And, you know, in the eyes of the FTC, they just haven't been making good on their promises that they made a couple of years ago when they signed this record $5 billion consent order where they promised that they would overhaul their privacy practices. And that meant protecting kids especially. If they can't collect data on kids, they're going to have to go through and definitely change a lot about what they do, and that could affect their bottom line.
Does the company agree that they've been delinquent in this?
Well, Facebook hasn't really said much about it. They have 30 days to respond to the FTC. The FTC will make a decision after that, and then, you know, if there's a decision, it could be appealed in a federal court of appeals. So we'll have to see where this goes. But, you know, it definitely shows that the FTC is cracking down and maybe looking at other social media companies, too.
There is a Messenger Kids app, right?
Yeah, and this is one of the things that the FTC highlighted, that it missed, that they're saying that Meta misrepresented what Messenger Kids gives kids access to and gives app developers access to when it comes to kids' personal data.
I suppose we're talking about where the kid is. Have they made purchases through the app or on their device, that sort of thing?
Well, it could be conversations that the kids are having. I mean, Facebook had pushed this kids app as a safer alternative and a more private alternative to regular Facebook, because kids were using Facebook, even though Facebook's user agreement says that you have to be 13 to have a Facebook account. And this was kind of a way to give kids access, but make sure that their privacy was protected at the same time. And apparently that wasn't really happening.
So here's what I said to myself when you said that. You have to be 13 to have a Facebook account, but you're probably 76.
Yeah, my kids have no interest in Facebook, but they are on Instagram, and that's Meta as well.
Today is Password Day, is that right?
Yep, it is World Password Day. You know, the appropriate gift would be getting your passwords in order. We all hate passwords. We're all guilty of not using good ones, maybe reusing passwords. God forbid you set a password that is the word password. You know, this is a reminder to lock down your logins. Make sure that you're doing everything you can to protect your data, because a bad password is just asking a cyber criminal to go after your data.
I think this is why I haven't used one of those password apps. A colleague of mine here has it on his phone. He was showing me how simple and easy it works. I think I'm worried that I'll forget the password to the password app.
But, well, that definitely is a danger when it comes to password managers, but they can be incredibly useful for remembering all those passwords. You know, another thing that people should do is make sure that they're using two-factor authentication. And what this does is it adds a second factor, like your fingerprint or your face or a physical key, to your password. So if your password is compromised, this goes a long way to keeping cyber criminals out.
And I think I could remember one single solitary password in my life if that's what I needed. I think I'm going to go with password 12346. You see what happened there?
That's probably the worst thing that you can do. But what you need to do is have a very long and unique, at least 12 characters. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with printing it out, putting it somewhere safe, and just having it there when you need it.
Well, that's what I did. In fact, this is the truth. We have a book by our computer, and it says in great big letters, secret passwords, so we're protected. But, you know, here's the other thing then. So how does that work? So if I use a password manager, then I'm at the Walgreens, and I want to, I mean, I've noticed this when I wanted to get pictures developed online from Walgreens. And so it says, what's your password? And I'm like going through my books trying to find out where we wrote it down. But if I had the app, I would call it up and there would be this convoluted 12-digit thing and I would look at it and then, and it wouldn't happen automatically. I would have to type it in based on what I'm seeing on my phone, right?
Yeah, I mean, what the password manager would do is, you know, ideally you'd be logged into it with your phone right there. And then it would autofill all your passwords. Yep. Oh, so what, okay. What's great about password managers too is it's not going to autofill it in a place where it's not supposed to be.
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, say that you clicked on a phishing link in an email and it took you to a fake Walgreens site, something like that. The password manager is going to look at that fake site, which may look exactly like Walgreens.
Really?
Website, and realize that this is not the real website. And it's going to tell you, no, I'm not putting your password in there.
I didn't
realize. So it can definitely
that.
Save your bacon.
I'm
yeah.
I'm really glad you mentioned that. Hey, real quick, I see that a jury has sided with Ed Sheeran, that he did not copy Marvin Gaye's music. Are you familiar with that story?
I did just see that pop up. I mean, it's, you know, it's definitely interesting when you listen to songs and how all that goes in that world.
Noticing that now, I'm going to have to play the two side by side and then decide for myself. But in the meantime, really good information from you today, Bree. Thanks for your help.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dale Buss from the Flyover Coalition about something that, how do I not know more about this? The veteran journalist and founder and executive director is back on WGN. How are you, Dale?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me back.
I didn't know that Illinois was selling water or rights to Lake Michigan. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. In fact, one of your news headlines just talked about the deal between Chicago and Joliet, I believe. And this whole thing kind of underscores the importance of water as a resource, you know, not just for Chicago and Illinois, but for the whole Great Lakes area. And this is something that's really been festering. I mean, the environmental balance of the Great Lakes, you know, the availability of water has always been a huge asset, kind of just sitting there and shimmering, right? For flyover country and especially the Great Lakes watershed, that as you see more stresses on climate or, you know, a 10-year stretch of bad weather, whatever it is we have, you see companies reacting more out of their own self-interest to the fact that we do have this water supply here. And in other parts of the country, you know, notably California, of course, the Southeast has had drought. This is water is a resource that's being eyed more in terms of economic development and even survival. So you've got the movement of water. I mean, it's not just Chicago to Joliet. There's been some movement from up north in the Milwaukee area, a suburb called Waukesha has tried to get water out of the Great Lakes. And there's all these fault lines and watershed, you know, scientific watershed boundaries and stuff that come into play. But just the fact is, water is being eyed all over the place as a more important resource that we have kind of uniquely in the Great Lakes area.
So, yeah, no kidding. 80% of North America's surface fresh water, 80% of North America's fresh water is in the Great Lakes. So here we sit in Chicago. And I'm looking
and probably, I think it's like 20% of the world's surface fresh water. It's a huge... huge amount, obviously.
So how fortunate for us recreationally, it keeps us cool, but then also
tourism.
But then we've signed this $1 billion deal to sell, Chicago has, its water.
Yeah.
I to be honest with you, didn't know that we had the right to do that. We can sell our water to other states, municipalities, whomever, huh?
Yeah, it seems weird. You could just kind of tap into that continually, but that is the fact under the Great Lakes. I think it's called the Great Lakes Water Compact. And I guess if every city on the Great Lakes started saying we're going to sell water, you know, hundreds of miles inland or dozens of miles, whatever, it could be a problem. But the Great Lakes obviously keep getting replenished. And I think if people look at regional patterns of, you know, distribution, it's kind of not such a big deal. But, you know, you have people talking now about, well, the Colorado River is running out and it powers a whole bunch of states down there, and why don't we just divert water from the Mississippi or the Great Lakes? Well, It just would never work economically, for one thing. It'd be trillions of dollars. It wouldn't be worth the effort. But it does make you appreciate more the value of the water that we do have here. And you are seeing more leveraging of water in, you know, what some people are calling a blue economy in economic development terms. So it's, you know, these microchip plants that are starting to be placed all over the place. You saw Ohio pitch its, you know, being on the Great Lakes to Intel when Intel decided to put their chip plant there last year.
Yeah.
You see an outfit like AppHarvest, which is a huge indoor agriculture operation in Kentucky, saying we're putting it here because there's ample water around here. So it's definitely coming into play more. The question is, you know, how do we leverage that? How do we use it? You know, can we overuse it? Can we endanger?
Well, I'm wondering about that a little bit. I mean, I'm thinking about Foxconn, and Foxconn never happened, but some of these manufacturers who say, hey, we're going to come to your state and we love the location and there's the lake. And I wonder if they're going to spoil the water, or if the water they use is going to be run off in some toxic way, and that's not good. Is that a legitimate concern?
Yeah, well, I think the environmental regulation is really tight. I mean, fortunately, the states around the Great Lakes and Canada really appreciate the environmental protection of the Great Lakes. I mean, that's why it's always such a big deal when the zebra mussels, you know, jump the barriers in the Chicago River on their way to Lake Michigan. I mean, it's people are on high alert for that. And so I'm not sure that's such a big problem. I think more to the point is what is the opportunity for us to use advancements in water technology to be able to, you know, take advantage of the water in an environmentally responsible way. In Milwaukee, I know there's a cluster of businesses that and kind of an institute at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee that's dedicated to, you know, economically exploiting the water resources that we have. And, you know, always have to keep in mind, as you mentioned, recreation, tourism. I mean, in Michigan, where I live, that's a huge, huge factor, right?
Yep.
You know, you're not going to do anything that's going to endanger the fact that we've got something like 3,300 miles of Great Lakes shoreline, and it's a huge part of the economy here.
Well, I want to share your optimism about that. I mean, I take your point, but the idea that the Asian carp or the zebra mussels might get into the lake, it happens or is a battle I don't know we're going to in the long run win, but I'm more interested in just companies using the water and then turning off some sort of pollution as a result. But I'll take your word for it that we're going to be prudent about this sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely have to be on our guard. And, you know, it's also, I mean, another aspect of being around the Great Lakes is that we have grid problems, right? So for whatever advantages we can get perhaps out of our adjacency to water and our fresh water supplies, those are sometimes negated by other factors that are weaknesses, such as problems with the grid. So I think water has to be kind of a part of a package of things that we use to appeal to companies and economic developers when they're looking to, you know, to place things. And but as you're suggesting, the environmental safeguards need to be there above all, or we'll find this great resource, you know, being spoiled.
Does anybody ever talk about the same way they have pipelines for, I know you mentioned this, it would be too expensive to divert the Mississippi, say, but I wonder if we can, the same way we have oil pipelines, have water pipelines, and you can get it to Arizona or someplace like that.
No, I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying is I looked into that a little bit myself and talked to folks, and they're like, it would just be ridiculously expensive. And I mean, I know there are natural gas pipelines that go for thousands of miles, but that's gas. And there are oil pipelines, but when it comes to water, it's just not something that's in the cards. And the other thing that we have to watch out for is, you know, water isn't just a benefit to us in this region. I mean, if you look at, don't go any further than the Great Plains, water is being stressed out there. The Ogallala Aquifer, which underlies the Great Plains states and provides a lot of irrigation for farming, you know, is kind of being tapped out. So we can have 80% of the fresh water in the United States in the Great Lakes, but that doesn't mean that as the climate changes, apparently that water isn't a challenge and a problem for us in this region as well. It's not all just sitting there looking lovely, right?
Yeah, right. Well, but yeah, I would hoard it if I were us, you know, if it ever came to that. And you can imagine a scenario in the future where there will be battles fought about water or the use of it, legislative battles, if nothing else. But I also think when I think about other parts of the country and how desirable they are, I think as the climate changes, a climate like Chicago's is looking better to me all the time. And the proximity to the lake, I think, is a plus.
Oh, absolutely. And there are things called climate refugees, right? You started to hear about that during COVID, particularly, where people just saying, hey, the hot air is getting hotter. I think I'll move to the Midwest and I'll move around the lake.
We haven't had one hurricane here. I'm out of time,
Dale.
Yeah,
that's true.
Dale Buss is a veteran journalist and founder and executive director of the Flyover Coalition. Flyovercoalition.org is the website. Intriguing ideas today, Dale. I'm glad you could join us.
All right. Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. United Airlines is planning to hire 15,000 employees this year, and a big chunk of the new hires will be in Chicago. The airline's looking to add nearly 4,000 new hires here in its home city. That includes roles at O'Hare Airport and in its corporate office. United also plans to hire about 2,300 people in Denver, where it's been aggressively adding service, and where it trains pilots. 2,100 will be added in Houston. United's current workforce of about 95,000 employees will include 50,000 new hires by 2026. The airline's also hiring about 2,300 pilots this year. Allstate has reported a first-quarter loss of $342 million despite higher premiums aimed at offsetting rising auto costs and catastrophe losses. The Northbrook-based insurer reported a $370 million profit during the same period last year. Allstate, like other insurers, has been hit with higher costs for used vehicles, replacement parts and labor for car repairs, and for new cars. It's been passing those higher costs onto customers through higher premiums. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you, sir. Okay, business of food time. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. Let's begin with this.
I want to say happy Black Farmers Week in the state of Illinois.
Oh, I am tardy in joining the celebration. Illinois Black Farmers Week was last week, but I'll embrace the better late than never excuse. But first, let's thank the Chevy Silverado HD for being our sponsor. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, Black Farmers in Illinois?
In 1920, Illinois had 892 Black Farmers.
And now?
As of the 2017 USDA Agricultural Census, there are 188 individually black-owned farms.
Sonia Harper is a state representative from the south side of Chicago and is chair of the House Agriculture Committee. There are more than 70,000 farms in Illinois, and fewer than 200 are owned by blacks, a reflection of what has happened nationwide. And
as agriculture is the largest job-producing industry in the state, and as farming has become big business, it has also become one of the least diverse industries in the state.
In Illinois, traditional farming is dominated by white farmers, but where black farmers dominate is in urban areas.
We have a beautiful network of black and brown farmers in the city of Chicago.
Boisa Itaji is with Growing Greater Inglewood.
We need more small farmers in cities growing food so that if the supply chain has any disruptions, we still have everything we need within our communities.
And urban farming is different.
We are helping to heal some of that soil. A lot of it is contaminated. And we are working to have more ecological practices of growing food, pulling on the African traditional practices of working with the soil, with the earth, and not against it.
Representative Harper says a handful of bills are circulating Springfield to help support black farm owners in Illinois.
This year, our ask specifically for the socially disadvantaged farmer grants is $5 million.
And at the federal level, billions of dollars for disadvantaged farmers were included in President Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus relief package, all of which advocates say is a step toward righting a wrong after a century of mistreatment of black farmers by the government and others. On our food calendar today, it's National Orange Juice Day, and it's International Respect for Chickens Day. I'm Steve Alexander, and that's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Colette English Dixon is the executive director of the Marshall Bennett Institute of Real Estate and the administrative chair, real estate at the Heller College of Business at Roosevelt University here in Chicago. Colette, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm well, John. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
That's a lot of introduction there. So what is it that you do, Colette?
I am responsible for the real estate program that's offered at Roosevelt University through the Institute. We have an undergraduate real estate major and minor. We have a graduate degree in real estate, and we have some graduate certificate programs. So we're all about real estate. So I do whatever is necessary to keep this going, except teach.
So is it that people would graduate from college with a degree in real estate? I thought that was something you sort of picked up after school, you know?
Well, you can, but I think that we are convinced that when students have a head start by understanding the industry better before they fall into it or start that first role in the industry, they tend to be more successful. Their learning curve is shorter. They can be engaged with the company they're working with faster. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big deal and makes a really big difference for the industry.
You are interested in getting greater diversity in the field as well, right?
Absolutely. You know, being a woman of color who's been in the commercial real estate industry my entire career before I stepped into this role, it is important for the industry to reflect the community that it works within. And that means there needs to be increased diversity. So at Roosevelt, we are a very diverse university, and fortunately, we can have that diversity roll through the real estate programs and then have an impact on the industry in Chicago and beyond.
You have a summer program for kids, right?
We do. I think it's really important for young people to understand this industry early. You know, a lot of people can see role models in different career paths. Real estate's a little bit harder to see. So we think the opportunity to share insights to the real estate industry with high school students before they start making, you know, career decisions and college decisions that go along with that will help fill that pipeline of talent that the industry needs. And we do that here in Chicago mid-July for about 11 days. They live with us at the university. They're housed in our beautiful residences on the top level of our new tower. And they get a chance to meet industry leaders, do hands-on projects, get to understand the industry, and I hope, you know, decide that this is a path that they want to pursue.
I think you could open up a lot of eyes for kids in a situation like that. What can we do for you? Do you want people to sign up? What's the ask here?
Well, the ask, I would say, is if you have an interest in being a part of providing these sort of opportunities to high school students, we're definitely looking for sponsors of our project teams. If you have an interest in that, you can reach me at cenglishdixon@roosevelt.edu. Additionally, we're always looking for young people who are in the industry who want to get knowledge to help advance their careers to consider going to grad school. And think about, you know, coming to us if you're thinking about a graduate degree that would advance your career in the real estate space. So two asks, you can come to school here, love to see you, undergrad or grad. And if you think it's important to support programs like ours for high school students, we'd love to talk to you about being a sponsor.
Colette English-Dixon is the first woman of color to lead a university real estate program nationally. Wow. I'm so glad that program is there, and I'm glad you are too. Thanks for joining us, Colette.
Thanks so much, John. Appreciate it.